Once more unto the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Personal Wealth Coach with a second hour. We are taking calls in here. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number to call is 254-773-1400. Last hour, we talked about a series of things, credit scores and some of the tax plans that are being put forth by presidential candidates. There's another tax plan we haven't touched on. We can touch on that. The president has mentioned multiple times about revising the capital gains tax. If so, the members of the Senate don't know about it yet. They have talked about not having had anything presented to them, and the president seems to have stepped back from that. He said in a couple of rallies that he may be talking about cutting the capital gains tax. That's a fascinating area. Haven't really talked much about it because we have zero definitive anything on the subject. It could be just something that he was testing the waters about. Cutting taxes right now when we're spending as much as we are, when the last tax cut at the corporate level, we definitely are getting less revenue from corporations. As a year-by-year situation, our percentage of overall revenue is much more concentrated on the individual side, just in general. But there was a small downtick in the taxes received last year from corporations, and that's even with new money coming back for investment from overseas. That's with that extra 10% tax on the shorter-term stuff they had sitting in cash positions over time overseas. They had enough time to put it in longer-term positions overseas. And there was a big shock in that they didn't bring it all home. And that was the part of the plan that I thought was going to be pretty good, is it would give a good incentive to bring back money to the United States. And it started to happen, and then the trade war happened. So then everything just since then has been relatively put on pause at the big corporate decision-making area. So it's just a thing to know out there. There are some talk at the administration level of lowering capital gains, but so far it's only been from one person, and that's the president. He hasn't passed off any plans on that. So we'll see. I'll be watching it, and whatever's proposed, I'll give you an analysis on it. There's two sides of the analysis for the tax code anytime we look at it. First is, what's it going to do for revenue? And second, what's it going to do to the people providing the revenue? So if it provides a great deal of revenue short term, but then it puts the people that provide that revenue out of business, then you're long term really hurting yourself by getting some extra money up front. That short-sightedness is kind of throughout our system now, not just on the governmental side. We make decisions that may be good for us short-term and may not be good for us long-term. At the corporate level, too, publicly traded corporations are reported. They're required to report every quarter, and that's been a what can you do this quarter for growth is more important in many ways to many people than what's the long-term health of the company. That's a problem that we're going to have to deal with. It's the problem that we're already dealing with in taxes. And what do I mean by that? Why is it that we owe taxes in April for a given period of time from January 1st to December 31st? Why those dates? If you think about, here's an example. Say you've let's use an income tax. You have been building up your reserves so you can make a purchase at the corporate level to buy a big piece of machinery, and you're planning on doing it in December. You have all of the money available. You've sold some other assets to make it ready. You want to do this, and then you'll be able to deduct the cost once you spend the money. Well, in this year, for some reason, that manufacturing equipment wasn't able to be purchased on time. So it's going to have to be purchased in January. Well, now you owe income taxes on the money that you're about to spend to purchase some manufacturing equipment. which if you had purchased it in December, you wouldn't have owed taxes on that money because it was fully deductible because it was a business expense. So this arbitrary line of December 31st, January 1st caused money that had the same purpose, the same earmark, to be taxable or untaxable depending on whether or not it was used by a given deadline. That's not good for the economy. We don't have a better solution, but that's one of the weaknesses with the tax code. How would you fix that? You could tax people monthly. Well, then that would make it harder to build up the reserve. You could do it multi-year periods. It's really difficult on the income level to say what the income is being used for. This is another reason why, generally speaking, a sales tax is a better idea. Texas can speak to that. And that you pay the sales tax when you buy the thing, and then it gets sent in. It does affect the price of the item you're buying, and because of that, it may make you decide not to buy as much of an item as you would have. But you're getting to make the decision at the point of sale. You get all of the information you need about how much you're going to pay in taxes at the point that you're doing the transaction, not 12 months later or 18 months later. If you do a transaction in January and you're doing your taxes and you've extended and you're now up close to October of the following year and you're still not quite sure what kind of deduction you get on that purchase. A sales tax, you know what the tax is immediately. And if you're using it for business purposes in Texas, you can get an exemption and say this is going into a product that we're making that we're about to sell later on at a greater price for more sales tax. So that's the concept. And so when looking at a tax system, looking purely at how much revenue is going to be made based on already existing systems, like the last 10 years, if people had paid this tax, here's how much money we would have received in revenue. That's a really bad way of estimating revenue, because if the tax had been there, they may not have bought as much of the stuff. It's really, we put politicians in a tough place where over the years, the income tax has become, man, I'm trying to use a word that is not unrepeatable on the air. The tax code is a monster, and it's gotten worse, not better, with the tax cut. It is obscenely complex and has gotten more obscenely complex with the changes in the corporate and small business taxes. It gets, you know, there's a lot of money being spent this year, and a lot of money was spent last year. A lot of money is going to be spent in the coming years in changing the way companies are incorporated, changing C corporations to S corporations, or S corporations to C corporations, or sole proprietorships to LLCs, or you get the impression. Everybody's looking at what's the best way to get the lowest tax. And that's a normal thing when a tax changes. It's kind of like water. It tries to find the path of least resistance. And when it comes to taxes, if you think of tax as a way of slowing down the flow of money, the market tries to find a way to get through this barrier, this dam, if you will, and flow on. And so until it finds what it determines is the most efficient route, it tries all kinds of things, the market being a lot of people. When a consensus forms and says, hey, here's the best way to deal with it, then Congress might look at it and say, oh, that's a loophole, I'm going to fix that. Or they might say, oh, we meant to do that, even if they didn't. So taxes changing, this horrible, nasty creature of the Internal Revenue Code. If we were to change from an income tax to a more efficient system like a sales tax, the surface thought on that, well, that would be a better system for the economy, so things would go great. The problem is that we would have to transition over a lot of years, because consider this. You're selling something to your customers. You're a business. And they tell you you're no longer going to have an income tax. You're rather going to have a sales tax. You're going to have to take some portion of the money you receive for the sale of this item and send it in immediately. Well, that has a tendency, particularly when people haven't gone through a year without the income tax, of just raising the prices. If the income tax goes away and the net revenue to the government is the same from the sales tax or the income tax, they're the same. So if you have them on a scale, you get the same revenue. That, in on average, over a long period of time, would mean that there would be no change in prices because it's the same same resistance. But from the individual person level, you've been informed you're going to have to raise the taxes on this sales item, and you don't know how much that's going to be, and you don't know how much to hold back, and are you going to do – you don't know what taxes are this year because income taxes are gone. It can cause prices to go through the roof and cause a really bad situation economically. So this is another case where good intentions could lead to really bad trouble. And we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. There was an article about refinance U.S. debt while rates are low. And I know everybody's talking about zero interest or negative interest. I'm familiar with refinancing your house, but when you're the piggy bank of the world, how does one go about refinancing $21 trillion? I'll hang up on this. Thank you.
All right. Good question. Very good question. How does one go about refinancing $21 trillion? Well, first off, we can split that out. There's about 7 trillion of that 21 that isn't on the debt market. It's debt that Congress owes to itself. Those are special treasury issues. That's for Social Security, Medicare. So take that off the table. That's not going to get refinanced in the same market way. It's refinanced at the congressional level where they just say, all right, we're going to extend this on at this interest rate for a little bit further. It's a market interest rate, but it's the 4-year maturity rate on U.S. Treasuries. They don't issue any 4 years, so it's like an average of 10 years and 30 years that have come down to the 4-year maturity. That's how much they charge on their own internal stuff, and that kind of goes indefinitely. It doesn't balloon like the other bonds. When you buy a bond for $10,000, at the end of the period of the bond, you get $10,000 back. That's the whole concept. With Congress, you don't have a balloon on that note. It doesn't all pay back. It doesn't mature and you get the whole principal back, because that's not how Social Security works. There's no big balloon payment to you for Social Security. You get a monthly payment. So take that $7 trillion and put it to the side. Now you got $14 trillion. And it's spread across different maturities. We're borrowing a lot of money. And some of the money that we're borrowing is to pay money on bonds that are maturing this year. So got to hold that in mind. We're already refinancing. If a 30-year bond matures this year that was issued, what, in 1989? Then you get your money back. Well, where did that money come from? The United States government is spending everything it has and borrowing. How did it come up with the money to pay you your bond back? Well, they issue a new bond in its place at this newer, lower interest rate. So the 1989 bond had a much higher interest rate than the bond that they could issue today. That's refinancing it at a lower rate. A lot of the borrowing that's been taking place in the last several years has been at the very, very short term, 2-year bond or 2-year bill time period. And what happened? What? Why? Well, because it's been really low interest rates. The problem with that is that that's really interest rate sensitive on the refinance side. If 2 years from now interest rates are up and they could have locked in a low interest rate at a really long period, then we're going to be really upset. 2 years from now, we might have a new president, or we might have the same president. If it's the same president, he probably does not want to see our interest payments go ballooning upward. So the idea here is, and Mnuchin this week was, that's the Secretary of Treasury, was talking about issuing 50-year bonds. He was toying around with the subject of issuing 50-year bonds at this extremely low interest rate. All a refinance is on the bond market for the U.S. Treasury, it's less expensive than refinancing your house, because they package those bonds internally at a very, very cheap cost to themselves. What does that mean? Well, usually a corporation, an investment bank, has to package a bond. If you're talking about a mortgage, then a mortgage bank is packaging that bond. They're saying, okay, we have to check all the credit, we have to check all that stuff on income. U.S. government packages itself and assumes that you know all that stuff. It does get rated, but the government doesn't pay the rating agent. S&P and Moody's, they go over to Ford or General Motors or Walmart, and Walmart or Ford or General Motors will pay them to rate their bonds. This is a good bond or a bad bond. The U.S. government doesn't care. They'll lower and raise the rate, and they don't call S&P or Moody's to come and say, are we still safe? Now, S&P and Moody's will still give their opinion. And when we started talking about not paying our debts, not raising the debt ceiling, Moody's lowered the debt rating of U.S. Treasuries. Not because of our credit rating, not because of how good we are as a nation in taxation and all of that, but because of our unwillingness to pay for the bill that we just spent. So, refinancing of the bond market, they just issue a new bond for the one that matures. That's it. And they'll time it so that they'll get the money in before the maturity of the old bond. So that's what's going on there. Okay, so what else has happened in this last week? Commerce Department issued out how people are spending money. What happened in the U.S. economy? How vehicle purchases are up. The unemployment numbers came in. We have a 3.7% unemployment for August. That's an important thing to know. It's flat. Didn't go up or down. Excuse me, up or down. What that means is that we are still functioning at what I think anybody that studies this would say is full employment. We're seeing wages up year over year, a pretty significant amount, between 3% and 4%, depending on who's measuring it. That's a big jump. Inflation has not been that high. The GDP numbers have been talked about as well. We are looking at GDP that in the first quarter was at 3.1%. That's a pretty healthy growth rate. Second quarter has now been revised down to 2%. And that has a weighing in on how much growth we're having this quarter. One of the Federal Reserve member, the chairman of the Chicago Federal Reserve Bank, he's a voting member on the board of the Federal Reserve. He said that he believes a sustainable U.S. GDP rate was 1.75%. That we have, it's really, really, really hard to grow at the rate we are and exceeding that going forward. So let's take a step back for a second and say, what is growth and why is it that we want it? What is GDP? Why is it that having everybody employed would make the GDP smaller? In order to grow, well, this is kind of obvious when I say it like this, but it's something that's kind of a new concept to a lot of people. In order to grow, you have to have room to expand. If you have no room to expand because you've filled up all the available space already, well, the next step would be, okay, knock out a wall somewhere and fill in more spots. Well, if you use that analogy and instead of a building, you've run out of space in the building, you've run out of the ability to hire people. That's going to slow down your ability to increase whatever it is that you do. It's going to slow down your ability to make more of the things that you're making because there's not enough people. You can't grow beyond there. Each person is doing the most that they can. Now, this can lead to productivity increases. This could be people are saying, all right, we can't hire more people, so we've got to find a way of doing better with the people that we have. When we're at a full employment situation, that is harder to do because the demand for the items that you're using or you're producing doesn't go away during that time period. So you have to stop producing for a minute to figure out a better way to produce. to retool yourself, to rethink, to re-educate, whatever it is that you consider doing, whatever you're making, to make it better, you have to stop making it the old way. And that takes time. That causes us to fall back, lose productivity before we gain it. That sort of thing lowers demand elsewhere because your employees might not be spending as much, thinking, hey, we're not making money right now. Maybe I won't have a job next month. So they cut back. This is why when we get to full capacity, when we're fully employed, everybody's got a job, or very nearly everybody's got a job. But because everybody has a job and we're retooling and looking around, and some people are saying, hey, we got to raise prices. The things that we've got coming in are coming in at a higher price. This causes worry, and it can cause people to buy more or to buy less. In this case, what's happened all the way up to this part of the year is people have been buying more. They're making more money than they have before, and that's been driving the economy. Will they flatten out in August? We've got more vehicle purchases, but everything else is flat. That means that we are still in a really healthy spot, but we're at that spot where all it takes is a little stumble, and we could have a negative GDP for a quarter. Just a little stumble, because we're at a slow growth rate and we're unable to grow faster because we don't have enough people. And in order to grow faster, we actually have to grow slower so we can figure out how to grow faster first. And this is kind of a good analogy. If you have a dog and the dog wants to go outside, this is one of those things that takes dogs. Some dogs never learn it, and some dogs learn it relatively quickly. But the look on their face as they're standing at the door and you're trying to back them away from the door so that you can open it so that they can go out. And they're kind of pushing back, saying, wait, you're pushing me away, but I want to go that way, and you're pushing me away from that way. In order to grow, whatever the business is, if you're at full capacity, full utilization, let's take it back in time. You're in a steam train. You're going at full speed. If you want to go faster, you've got to upgrade your boiler. You've got to upgrade your furnace. You've got to stop the train and overhaul it to make it go faster. Well, that means in order to go faster, you have to go slower first. That's what recessions are. And when we say, look out, there may be a recession coming, it's that. The economy needs to take some time to retool. Unfortunately, it's become kind of political, and there's people rooting for recessions on the Democrat side. I think that's disgusting. We shouldn't be rooting for weakness in the economy. We should look at it as weather. It happens. Be prepared for it when it does. Not, let's hope a hurricane hits. That's stupid. That's really not a good, I mean, even if it makes somebody not get reelected. It's just dumb. Why go down that? Why should we shoot ourselves in the foot so that we can't win the race? Well, then we can stop and bandage the foot. Yes, but you had a blister on your other foot, so you shot yourself in the foot so that you could take the time to heal. It's don't spite yourself because you don't like a given situation. And this is politically, there are three major candidates right now. One of them is already president, whose solution to things seems to be break the system and then try to rebuild it, but without a real plan for what they're rebuilding to. And that causes uncertainty. It doesn't mean that they have bad ideas. And this is something, people just heard me going nuts the first hour on Elizabeth Warren's tax plan. That doesn't mean it's a bad plan. It means that for our economy, I think it would be a bad plan. But there are certain economies that it would work really well in. And this is one of those weird situations where one size does not fit all. Cultures are different. Economies are different. And there's some kind of intertanglement of that culture and the economy. In the United States, failure needs to be an option. And this is something I use as an example really regularly with clients, and I've said it on the air before. In the United States, we are the only place in the world that if you're looking at two billionaires, One of them failed 5 times and picked themselves up and scrambled and came back up to being more powerful, more wealthy than they were before. And the other one inherited every dollar and hasn't done anything with it. Who do you respect more? And in America, we're the only place that says we respect that guy that failed so many times first. That's the guy that really knows what he's doing. And that's a great thing. Without that, we are not innovative. Innovative means taking risks. That means we gotta fail sometimes. Failure needs to be an option. Bankruptcy needs to be an option. Recession needs to be an option. Otherwise, we're no longer gonna lead the world in innovation and profitability. I mean, when you really buckle down into it, why is it that we're having the trade war with China? Well, we're having the trade war with China because they're sneaking our innovation without innovating themselves. And people have heard us talk badly about the tariffs and the trade war. The reason for the trade war is valid. China has been a bad actor for a long time. They finally got big enough as far as their economy is concerned for us to start recognizing that if we continue down this path, it's not good. When it's Thailand or Vietnam and they say, hey, tell us how to make these things and we'll make it for you, and we tell them, all right, here's the blueprint, you fill it out like this, we're not all that concerned. It's not a big deal. Because we don't believe that they have the capability of turning around and opening up another plant and doing exactly the same thing. They don't have the wealth. Well, China has developed the wealth now. We've paid them well enough that now they have the ability to turn around and do the same thing that we're doing based on the technology that we created, not them. That's a bad thing. Intellectual property rights are sacrosanct in my mind. They are, if you do not honor them really well, you lose the ability to make new things, to create new things and innovate, to invent. If you make an invention in the United States and you patent it, it may be hard to figure out how to sell it. It may take you a while to get it to the right networks and sell it through the right venues and get it manufactured the right way. But once you do, you get to keep your profit. And if you've patented it and somebody else starts making it, you can sue them, and that's a pretty lucrative lawsuit. They'll give you a lot of money for doing it. They look at that as theft. They're stealing your stuff. People in China, when they invent something, are afraid to make it because their competitors might make more of it, and they have no protection against that. So at some point, when limiting China's ability to steal technology doesn't limit the problem in the future. They still have to figure out how to innovate, or they're going to find other ways of taking the technology. So I think one of the things that we can do is help them learn to innovate. As long as we stay allies, that's a good thing. If we don't let them learn to innovate, we continue to innovate and they just continue to copy what we make. They're not as huge a threat as many would think, because all we have to do is figure out how to keep them from taking our ideas. That's a big, big solution to come up with. All right, so another kind of oddity, and I'm going to give a parallel here. It sounds like I'm about to change the subject really, really massively. Bear with me. The Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement. Wow, that's a big shift from tariffs and intellectual property to whether or not a country should be allowed to make a bomb. Okay, so when that came out, it was totally voluntary. The countries could come and sign it. Whatever it was internal to that country to ratify a treaty was done. In the United States, treaties are ratified and treated at the same level as the Constitution, unless it's the Cherokees and the Trail of Tears. That's kind of an embarrassment, a big embarrassment on our past. We violated the Constitution twice in that. The treaty was violated, and then the Supreme Court's order was violated by the president. Now, there's good things that president did as well, but that's kind of it's a massive blemish on our history. Okay, so treaties by law in our country are the same level as the Constitution. This treaty, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, allows a voluntary removal of yourself. If you're a country and you signed up for it, you're allowed to remove yourself. It's a 2-year process. It has to, you have to file all the right forms and to inform all the other countries and go about the process correctly. And then you can get out of it. So at the time that the treaty was signed, there were 2 major powers with nuclear weapons and more were getting them. It was kind of questionable about who had them. Maybe the UK had it. Maybe they didn't. Probably did. Israel was definitely working on it. Pakistan and India were in a race for it. So we went around to all these nations and we said, we'd like you to sign the treaty. At this point in history, this is post-World War II, the threats are between these 2 big superpowers. And there were a lot of nations that were literally still in the Stone Age, maybe the Stick Age. And they were just being introduced to metal tools in their farming, hand tools. And this emerging economy that we've gotten in the last 80 years out of that situation, as people have come up out of using a rock, literally using a rock to cut rice, a sharpened rock to cut rice, or a sharpened piece of bamboo to cut rice in the paddy, to using a metal sickle, to then working in a manufacturing facility, has had this big explosion of growth and innovation, wealth and prosperity and technology. Their standard of living has risen drastically. But back when the treaty was being signed, the leaders of that nation, come to a nation that's in essence in the Stone Age and say, please sign this to say that you are never going to make a nuclear bomb and you will be our friend. And the nation goes, yep, we have no way of making a nuclear bomb. Let's sign that, and now we'll be their friend. Okay, so that's the environment. North Korea, we have to look at them differently. Let's take a different lens out here. We tend to look at governments by the standard of the 20th and 21st century, the late 20th century and 21st century. We tend to say democratic, some kind of republic. That's the normal. North Korea has a god king. You can call him the premier or the president all you want. It's a god king. He's a multi-generational god king. Think like a pharaoh. There's a pharaoh here. He is, in his mind and in the minds of most of his followers, a greater entity than they are. Okay. So that's out of the way. They signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. They then removed themselves from the treaty over the process of several years. It's written in the treaty. The UN then passed a resolution saying, no, you can't have nuclear weapons. We know we said it was all voluntary. We know that that's what we said, but subtext, you're a god king, you don't get nuclear weapons. And I kind of respect that opinion. I don't want god kings with nuclear weapons. And when I say a god king, it means that he is, in essence, deified in his country. Not that I think he has some kind of supernatural abilities. Simply that he is being treated like a deity in his country. His birthday is celebrated for the whole month with fireworks and national performances. I mean, this is pageantry and religious activity. In any other situation, this would be seriously considered a religious activity. Okay. So what does that have to do with tariffs? It's unintended consequences. We have a structure that over many centuries has developed. The United States was formed from scratch. Most nations have to deal with their former governments and the legacies of their former governments going back through lots and lots of weird periods of monarchy and dictatorship and all the other things that happen in many countries. We've had one government until we had the Civil War, but even the Civil War had a similar government. You can say bad decisions, good decisions were made by them, but we have a system that we've been following all the way through that we created. And we've given that to other people in the world. And part of that system is honoring the rule of law. And so we say, all right, here's the treaty. This is the rule of law. Here you go. And you honored the treaty, but you're still bad. We should have made a different method in that treaty. It was a bad mistake to do it that way. Just like it's not the best move to instigate tariffs on taxation on your own people to prevent another country from doing something. And I know that's it's a weird one. It's a really complex set of decisions that have to be made there. But what is the solution to China taking our intellectual property if we don't use tariffs? Because how else are we going to do this? Are we going to have some kind of a treaty with them, a free trade? Well, we got to get them to the table somehow. Well, why not use tariffs? Because we're not working on a treaty. We're working on some kind of a trade deal like NAFTA or like the USMCA. That's not a treaty level event. It means anybody can change it. It means a president can alter it. It means that their president can alter it in the future. If we want to get this solved for real, we open up real diplomatic proceedings to say, how can we benefit each other with trade? So that you're not taking too much from us and we're not taking too much from you and we have a good relationship in trade going forward. How do we do it so we protect our own workers and you protect your own workers and everybody's happy in this deal? Well, nobody's always going to be. There's never a time when everybody's happy. But free trade agreements between allies tend to increase the wealth and prosperity of both allies. This isn't a maybe. This is when we measure it across history, it's consistently true. It isn't, and employment situations are consistently improved by having free trade. So this concept of trade, of unintended consequences, kind of stretches across a whole swath of areas. And I'm going to play some commercials. I'll come back on the other side. We'll talk about more of some of the stuff that happened this week. We'll talk about got some other really, really good stuff in here. The fiduciary standards, what they mean, why it's important. This is a big one. How many rules that worked in finance, personal finance at an earlier generation can put a great burden on the current generation. So we'll talk about that more after the break. If you would like to join the conversation, the phone number here is 254-773-1400. I'll be back. And I'm back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure. The phone number in here is 254-773-1400. Really appreciate you guys listening. I have a lot of fun doing this, and hopefully I'm adding to your knowledge base. I wanted to talk about a generational shift in personal finance. A lot of parents that have kids either about to go into college or in college right now have been talking to their kids over the years about you need to go to college and you need to buy a house and kind of in what order. But they're dealing with a memory of a different situation. Most people whose kids are in college now or have graduated in the last 10 years are in a situation where if they went to college, the parents here, they went to college for a much lower price. And they looked at it and they said, this has provided me with a great deal of income and success throughout my life. So they're telling their kid, go to college for something, anything, go to college. And that's not necessarily a good idea. Not just blanket across the board, just go to college. Send them to community college for a couple of years to get all the prerequisites out of the way and help them define what it is that they want to study for. Because going to school for the wrong thing and spending that much money on it is really, really hard on life afterwards. I am extremely proud of who my wife is and what she's done, and she's proud of what I've done and who I am. She got her degree in international relations, which is one of those degrees that has one of the highest rates of student loans about them. And then when you have the job as a relatively low-paying job. If you're in international relations, you're probably working for a government somewhere doing something semi-diplomatic. And pay is the same at the governmental level, kind of across the board at that level. It's just not very high. So there's some college forgiveness programs that people can go into. What's important is to really define for yourselves in advance the things that they're interested in, not what they want to do for a living. That's different. Hold on to that for a second. Define their interests. What motivates them? What's their favorite subject in school? Figure that out. Then figure out a way to make a living doing the thing that they like doing, that they love doing. That's a different scenario than just go to school, get a degree, any degree, go for it. That can be dangerous, and people can make a bad decision that affects the entirety of the rest of their life. Now there's a high-pressure situation. What shall I choose to study? Choose to study what you enjoy, and then find a way to make a living doing it. It requires some creativity. My dad's, and I have a great deal of respect for him, he is a brilliant man and has a great deal of experience. But for many years, he talked about college and said advanced basket weaving as if that was always a bad choice. But I know several people in Austin making very large six-figure incomes because they started up businesses that make baskets and sell them at farmers markets. They hand make baskets, but they're beautiful baskets and they're handmade. And people buy them. It's kind of amazing. There's a demand for baskets. So if you have a master's degree in advanced basket weaving, it is not necessarily a you are never going to make any money. This could be the beginning of a really, really nice career. Determining that you love to do something should come before determining what you want to do with it to make a profit. And I could go into personal examples, and I think that's a little too personal on the air. But if you're thinking about going into a specific field, whatever the field is, stop a moment and say, do you like the field? I know that's something. Don't make the decision based on how much money you make in the field. That's a statistic that's based on the aggregate. It's based on the average. Find the thing you really enjoy doing and then get creative out of how to make a living doing it. And this is the old school American way of doing things. Most Americans don't do the thing that they have their degree in, most college educated Americans. Wouldn't it be cool if they did the thing that they had the degree in? If they could make the decision to get the education on the subject that they're actually going to do because that's what they like to do? It gives you a big head up over your competitors in the same field that got a degree in something else. So the more focused you can be on what you enjoy, the more focused you can be on doing it for a longer period of time. And I'm going to use an example of a person who, as a teenager, really enjoyed playing games. He's a young man, really enjoyed playing games. I think most people will say that they know teenagers in this category, insistent to his parents that he wanted to be in the gaming industry. And his parents, for his safety, really tried to discourage him from it. They said, you're never going to be able to make a living doing that. You need to pick something else to make a living in. You can't do it this way. You are, you know, this is like becoming an actor or something like that. You're not going to make a living. Okay. Well, come forward, I guess 25, 30 years now, and he's got a career in the gaming world. Now, it took him 20 years to get there, but he's very successful in the gaming world. It's something that he's always wanted to do, but he took to heart what his parents were saying. He had a lot of arguments about it, but he took it to heart, and he went a different route, and now he's in the gaming world. And he's doing well, and he's gone back to school and gotten a degree in gaming, a master's degree in computer science. If he'd gotten it to begin with, it would have jump-started the whole thing way back at the beginning. And here it is, you're going to have to bear with me here because I'm going to use some specific game names. At the time, one of the games that he was playing was Dungeons and Dragons. If his parents had instead, as a teenager, had instead told him, "You want to do this for a living? All right. Your job is to write a Dungeons and Dragons adventure every week and send it off to the gaming magazine of your choice every week. If you can, contact somebody there so that you have a point of contact to address it to." And that's it. You've got your other stuff that you're working on, but this is considered high enough priority that this is training for what you want to do. So build this thing that you want to do this. This is what you want to do. Start doing it. And then after you've been doing it for a while, contact that person and say, "What kind of degree would help me do what I need to do to be in this business?" And get a relationship with the people you want to work with and build your career path around it. And then when you graduate from college with the degree and you show up with your resume or you send your resume, it's going to be treated differently than the other resumes. This is the kid that's been sending us an adventure every week for the last 7 years. That causes a business owner to say this person is committed to what they want to do. They're really driven to do this. So find the thing that they love. And if they don't have a thing that they love, they need to find one because that's kind of how are they going to be happy in life if they don't have a thing that they love to do? And some of us just love sitting down and watching TV. Well, I have clients that work in the TV industry. Some people like to listen to radio. I have clients that do radio. If you think about what you like to do and what you wish you had known in your own career path in advance, it's going to be different from what your child wants, but mold it to what they want. How can you game the system to help them make a living doing something that they absolutely adore? The fact that most people say you don't want to go in the gaming industry, nobody makes a living there, is based on the average salary of people in the gaming industry. The average salary is because the vast majority of game programmers only work in game programming for a few years and then bail out. The people that are there because they really love to do it and they have been preparing to do it for a long time stay the course and wind up, on average, wind up making pretty good pay. So it's about commitment and recognizing what hard work is. And if you give them a task like writing an adventure or learning programming in high school, there's all kinds of online courses you can take that are relatively easy that allow you to pick and choose what parts you want to learn at what point. Assign a project. If they're in computer science and they want to do it that way, assign them a project of making a simple computer game. Help them out with it. What have you done there? That's as important or maybe more important than putting money away for their college. Your emotional support for what they love will give them a bedrock to get through hard times. Just support them in doing it. Remind them how much they love it when they're feeling rough about it. And then when they're feeling like nothing could go wrong, remind them of the hard times. And that, I would say, will allow your kids to make really good decisions on college. And the tendency there is to bring down the cost of college tremendously, fewer student loans, because it's focused on what you want, not on the generalities of these are the things that I should get just in case. All right. Well, we're about out of time for this week, and I hope that that was not too far off the economics subject. It's economics. It's at the decision-making level, at the very personal level. But it's maybe some of the most important decisions that you can make for your offspring and help them make for themselves. We're about out of time. If you would like to contact us off the air, we do give fiduciary investment advice to people of high net worth and people with trusts or corporations, LLCs. We work with foundations and charities as well. You can give us a call at 254-947-1111, and we'll have voicemail waiting there during the weekend. Real live people during the week. We're proud of that. We don't want to go computerized. We like the concept of being personal. It's in our name, the Personal Wealth Coach. So if you want to reach that number toll-free, it's 1-800-914-7526. You can go to our website. Well, that's 800-914-PLAN for those who can not memorize phone numbers the first time you hear it, which includes me. You can go to our website, which is thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. And on that site, we have a lot of information about how we do business, what our philosophy is. We have a lot of newsletters going back quite a few years. You can see what we were talking about and if we were actually predictive, if we said these things might happen and if they did. There's recordings of the radio program going back quite a few years as well. So look back and see, watch us change from extremely optimistic at the depths of when the beginning of the recovery was occurring to steadily more conservative as the market and the economy have grown. Until now, we're saying it's a beautiful scenario we're in right now. We're in a golden era. Don't go into a lot of debt. If you have debt, pay it off. Because golden eras have an end, and then we'll have a recession. And that generally leads to another golden era after. This is just part of the cycle. So get prepared for a time when it's raining. Buy the umbrella when it's dry. Do that with your finances. That's about all the time I have this week. Thank you very much for listening. I've enjoyed shaking your ear. Until next week, this is the Personal Wealth Coach.